The Blast from Our Past Network.
Hey everybody, Corey here.
And it's me, Zach.
We wanted to tell you about our new show called The Coscarelli Factor.
You can find it on our Patreon at patreon.com/podcastingafterdark. The Coscarelli Factor covers every single film that Don Coscarelli has directed. And some other little bonus features in there too, like maybe the music videos he directed as well.
That's right. You can find all the episodes under the Auteur de Force tier on our Patreon page. Like Zach said, that's patreon.com/podcastingafterdark. And if you sign up today, you will get access to the complete Carpenter Factor series, where Zach and I went through every single movie that John Carpenter directed, from Dark Star all the way to, well, all the way till the end. So sign up today to our Patreon page and you can unlock all kinds of other things as well, like ad-free episodes and our monthly wrap-up After Dark show.
Patreon helps keep the lights on in the podcasting After Dark world. It gets pretty dark out there at night and all your support keeps us from getting too scared.
And thank you to everyone who's signed up to our Patreon page. We really appreciate it. And as always,
we'll catch you on the dark side.
Welcome to our exclusive interview series for Podcasting After Dark with your hosts, Corey Stevenson and Zach Schaefer. Tonight's interview is with the star of Phantasm and the singer-songwriter known for his album Five Loaves, Two Fishes and for the song Cheyenne, with the Remington Ridge Trio, actor, singer, songwriter, Bill Thornbury.
I don't know about you, Corey, but I am so honored and thrilled to have our guest Bill Thornbury on the show today.
No, this is amazing. What an amazing day. Thank you, Bill, for coming on the show.
Man, thank you for having me on, guys. It's really special. Beautiful day. Watching my grandson through the windows here, playing out in the backyard. And yeah, all things considered, it is a great day. It's wonderful. That's you guys.
Well, I'm glad they're outside playing. I'm up here in Oregon, and it's pouring down raining. So, listeners, if you hear rain in the background, that's from me, and I apologize.
Okay, so it's raining up there. It's sun shining and about 70 degrees here today.
Nice.
Likewise here in sunny Southern California.
Yes, sir.
Bill and I had the pleasure of meeting each other about a month ago down in Burbank at Dark Delicacies. Uh-huh. Dark Delicacies was doing a book signing for a good friend of yours, yeah. Mr. Don Coscarelli. Mm-hmm. And not only was Don there with I believe his illustrator for the book, but also you were there too, and Reggie and Gigi were there. Yeah. And I have met Reggie before quite a few times in the past, and
absolutely.
But I never had the opportunity to meet you. So I was with my son. My son braved a 3-hour long line.
Yeah, well, you should have just snuck in the back.
I should have, you know. Kids typically kind of have that, you know, with a grandkid now, with your own kids, kids are kind of that gateway to like get either stuff or get to the front of the line.
Got the power. But yeah, well, next time, you know, we just We'll make sure that you don't have to wait for 3 hours, Zach. Okay.
Yeah, we'll give you. I'll give you a heads up ahead of time. But one thing that stood out to me was when we finally got into this great signing, by the way, the whole experience, and I would love to talk to you about that as well. When I got a chance to meet you, you were playing, and you came off the stage, and you looked at me, and I kind of gave each other a look like, "Hey, man, I know you from somewhere. I've met you before."
Yeah,
you know, and it was kind of that cool, soulful thing going on there.
Yeah, there was a lot of soul there, and I'm kind of looking at it right here. I can
right see on, man. And my son Bodie was like, you know, he's just there for the ride. He's just super supportive. Corey knows. Yeah. Corey's like
he's
his
a great
uncle.
Kid.
And then you and I were talking about the song Wildfire for a minute.
We did talk about that, Michael Martin Murphy.
Right. And you had met. So for those that don't know, there's a song, and I might have mentioned it to you, Corey. There's a song called Wildfire by Michael Martin Murphy. It's a 70s, you know.
Beautiful record.
Beautiful. Yeah, the whole album's amazing. But this song is a very tragic, dark song. But it's a beautiful song. And my son used to sing it all the time back in the day.
I connected with him even at, yeah, how old's your son now?
He's almost 10.
So, oh, at a great age.
Yeah.
Like fifth grade, right?
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. Like he's fourth grade now. And, you know, my wife's like, he's got facial hair. He's getting like peach fuzz, you know.
Kind of cool growing up right
fast.
Before you.
Anyways, it was just a moment to me where I was like, yeah, because I really dig that song and your music. It has that quality to it, you know, and obviously Corey and I grew up seeing you in the movie Phantasm. But there was something musically connected to like your acting, your presence that really just resonated, I think, with me personally. But I know, you know, obviously with fans worldwide, they love your music.
Oh, well, thank you. And, you know, just to kind of wrap that up with Michael Martin Murphy, I traveled with a group called the Sons of the San Joaquin, which were recently, well, not that recently, probably about 15 years ago, we were inducted into the Western Music Hall of Fame.
Wow.
The star is in not in Hollywood, but it's in Santa Clarita.
Yeah. Well, it's not too far.
Right? Where they have the big, beautiful Gene Autry Melody Ranch there with the sound stage and the full Western town. And they host every year the Cowboy Music and Poetry Festival there that thousands attend there, and the Sons of San Joaquin, we were there every year for many years. And but the Sons are no longer anymore. Our fearless leader, Jack Hanna, passed away 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years ago, actually, in August. So anyway, but life goes on, and it was a great ride, you know, for those years that we were together. And we did shows with Michael Martin Murphy and other great. We did a gig with Rita Coolidge. Do you remember her?
Yeah, oh, of course I do. I remember Rita Coolidge.
Chris Christopherson. And so that's the cowboy culture. You know, it's not the big country music culture, but there is a huge fan base out there. And fans are wonderful. And whether it's Phantasm fans or cowboy fans, Sons of San Joaquin fans, love them. And it wouldn't be a meaningful situation as a performer if it wasn't for the beautiful fans out there, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. And what you're describing too between country and country western is a different vibe. I spent a long time in Taos, New Mexico.
Love that. Well, Michael Martin Murphy lives very near there.
Right. And that's the culture I think you're speaking of, is that kind of, you know, big sky country, sitting on a ranch and looking out at the juniper bushes or whatnot and sagebrush. And anyways.
Do you find that, you know, meeting fans, is there a cross pollination between the Phantasm groups and the music group and the cowboy groups?
You know, the main thing is there's one group has a lot more tattoos than the other.
Yeah.
But No, I'm just being silly, but
no, it's probably true though.
Actually, I got to tell you one tattoo story. I was with Coscarelli and Mike and Reggie, and we were back in New York for a function back there, an event. And Don said, "Oh man, you got to meet this fan over here. He's a young man, you know, probably in his early 20s, just there." And you could just tell that he was a huge fan of the movie and everything. And he was, "Come over here, you got to meet him." So I met him, and he goes, "Yeah, check it out." And we looked down, and he had the tall man, Angus Scrimm, tattooed on his leg, going down from his knee all the way to his ankle, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And, I mean, it was really a perfect work. I mean, it looked exactly like Angus, you know. And I said, "Man, that's incredible, man. Just beautiful work, you know. It's nice that, you know, you love the movie so much that you would put Angus's, you know, likeness image right on your leg like that." Don goes, "Yeah, well, pull up your pant leg and show him the other thing." So he pulls up his shorts there, and right above his kneecap, he had Jody Pearson's face tattooed right on there. And I was just kind of like taken aback and completely like blown away that, you
You're
know,
like, somebody... that's me.
So it wasn't a likeness of me. It was absolutely my face. I guess technology for doing tattoos can get really exact.
Yeah.
I look pretty good, you know,
on some kid's leg.
I'm glad it wasn't recently. It wouldn't have worked out quite so well. But anyway, in those kind of instances and those kind of memories are so vivid and wonderful. And well, we're doing another event coming up in October, and we're all going to be there in Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
I have family out there in Kentucky. That's awesome.
Yeah. We've been there before. We were in Louisville right before COVID. And those events, I really did not partake in those, you know, that much.
Right.
You know, back when the movie first, you know, became kind of a hit and everything, it was all about the music for me. And I had gotten signed to a record label in LA first.
Okay.
And I wrote music for them, and then I eventually made it to Nashville, and then was signed by none other than the MTM company.
Oh. It
was Mary Tyler Moore. They branched out.
Oh, wow.
And started a record label there.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Our buddy Diallo is a big Mary Tyler Moore fan.
Yeah, boy, MTM. And so I was the first male artist that they signed.
No kidding.
Jim Croce's producer and publisher, Tommy West, was head of A&R. And I thought that was a good fit for me.
Yeah, no doubt.
And Alan Bernard was a great guy. He was Andy Williams. Do you remember Andy Williams?
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Andy Williams, he was his executive producer of the Andy Williams Show and his personal manager. And he was getting older then, but he had great stories. And I used to listen to Andy Williams as a kid, you know. I'd listen to a variety of tunes, you know, from Blind Faith and Cream to Andy.
Oh, nice.
Beach Boys and Chicago. And I mean, I was just raised on all kinds of music, and I appreciate all kinds of music, you know. But it was a great ride. MTM didn't last long. They sold, and my publishing catalog was, I think it's with Universal Music now.
Okay.
Probably collecting a lot of honking dust, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. Unfortunately, you know, the other day, actually, I was just listening to a record with my son, Bodie. We have a huge vinyl collection. Corey knows, Corey knows that I'm always, he's like, well, who's this guy? Who's that guy? He listens to a lot of, Corey has very great taste too in music. Don't get me wrong, Corey. But oftentimes you and I are like, I'm riffing on songs that you're like, I've never heard of that. Oh, I gotta write this one down or whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember vividly having my son sitting on my lap, listening to Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band Born to Run album from beginning to end, and him watching me flip the record and put it on the needle and on the vinyl.
Yeah.
And And he was looking at the Warner Brothers logo, and he's like, why is the Warner Brothers logo on this album? And I said, well, Warner Brothers has a music label too. He's like, oh, really? I go, yeah. I said, labels are like not really a thing anymore, I suppose, but
it's changed, you know,
so much.
All the social platforms and Spotify,
yeah.
All those internet connections and everything, so.
It's crazy, but you were speaking to a very eclectic taste, and I kind of echo that. I think you do too, Corey.
Yeah, yeah.
You have very diverse taste. But was music always a part of who you are as a person?
Absolutely. I moved to Los Angeles after I graduated from high school. I'd been real busy with, you know, just a typical life growing up, singing, and I kind of knew that I had the gift there as a singer first, as a little boy, you know, and started singing, you know, every Sunday at church, you know, and then you know, I got involved in music in elementary school and wrote my first song through the graduating class at Roosevelt Middle School, you know, and I, you know,
well, no kidding,
called middle school back in that day, it was just 6th, 7th, and 8th grade is what it was.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. And then in high school, I sang in, you know, just groups and madrigals and, you know, things like that, that really helped me, you know, cut my chops. And I picked up the guitar in sixth grade. I really took off. I started to play earlier than that, but it was really it was Ed Sullivan night when the Beatles hit, you know, the airwaves.
Yeah.
And I formed a, you know, like a Beatle band in sixth grade.
As you should, I'm sure.
and you know, we played at a school assembly, and we did, I'm a real nowhere man.
Oh, nice.
Nowhere man. Anyway, so we did the show, and or did the, what do you call it? The assembly. And
the gig, yeah, the assembly.
We did the gig, and backstage in the little school auditorium, the cutest girl in the school, Karen Christensen, ran back and said, you are better than the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. That's what every sixth grader wants to hear.
I was thinking, I have picked the right thing to do, man. It was great. I mean, it's really about the music, but there's that kind of,
well,
there's another aspect that's hard to ignore, right? I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, but
I'm not going to disagree with you. I've been in a band. I've been in bands throughout my life, and my brother's a drummer, and he and I were in a Kiss cover band in the early 90s.
So you're a guitar player?
Yeah, I play a few chords. I'm mostly the singer. I always sing for bands.
Front man. Well,
yeah.
Come on.
Corey seed me.
I have. I saw you at the Viper Room, buddy. It was a great show.
That was fun.
I have no musical talent whatsoever.
You know what? You've got good ears.
There you go.
He does.
You know,
and I know what you're speaking about, Bill, to that effect of the music is what matters ultimately. But when you are in front of a crowd, or if you're in front of a group of people, doesn't matter whether it's 5 or 50,
yeah,
there's a vibe. If they're feeling the music and they're cheering you on, it makes you want to do it again and again and again.
Yeah. You were kind of an anchor that day when you were at the Dark Delicacies event for the book signing, you know, you know what it is. You're playing, and you kind of lock in with somebody that looks like they're enjoying them, what you're doing.
Yeah. I really appreciate it. And you know, look, I was a kindergarten teacher for 15 years.
What?
And yeah, this is a whole other story.
I'm not worthy, right?
But one thing I always told my kids when we would go to assemblies and have special guests, and I said, always make eye contact with the person performing. Always smile. At least show them, if you're enjoying it, show them you're enjoying it, because it matters. You know, when you look out at a crowd and you see a bunch of dead faces or people who are caught in their own thoughts.
Right.
I get distracted. I know other people do too. Like, you get a little like, well, are they paying attention to me? Do they like what they're hearing right now?
Right.
I said, if you like it, make them feel it.
Applaud. We went to a Ghostbusters show, and Harold Ramis's daughter has a book called like Ghostbusters Daughter, and it's a beautiful book. And she was doing like a talk, and she was kind of nervous, and my wife became her anchor, and my wife was like crying during it and everything, and they were just like locked on. And then she did the signing, and Harold Ramis's daughter thanked my wife for kind of for the same thing, for like being my anchor for that. And I was like, that's a beautiful thing that you guys shared this, you know, this moment that'll always exist together. I mean, like I said, I don't have any of that kind of ability, but I cherish people who do have musical ability and get up there and you know, contribute such beauty to the world, you know.
It's what it's all about. You know, you don't have to have a guitar to do that. You don't have to sing to do that.
That's true.
Whatever your gifts are, you know, that's, you know, we're there to bring peace and harmony to the planet. That's what I think.
We need more of it. But I got to tell you, yeah, you were performing. You were playing a Crosby, Stills, Nash song at one point, but you were playing Sitting There at Midnight and or Sitting at Midnight and you started, and I never heard it live, and I just had a moment because sincerely, it is cinematically one of my all-time favorite moments on screen, whether it bar none, like to the point where my band used to cover that song.
Sitting Here at Midnight?
Yeah.
Doing like Crosby, Stills, and Nash too.
No, Sitting Here at Midnight.
Okay.
and then I remember meeting Reggie 15, 20 years ago and saying the same thing to him when he was selling his CD, his Jizz Wailing Ya Doggies, which I still have, by the way.
Jizz Wailing Ya Doggies.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got a workshop, man. He's always been a great friend. We used to hang out after the movie, during the movie, after the movie, we just hung out a lot. You know, I was with his dad and his mom and at their place down in Long Beach and everything. So we are family, you know, and
it really feels that way from the Dark Delicacy event. You know, I think there's something beautiful, and Corey and I have brought this up many times about Don Coscarelli's films and his relationship with his performers and behind the camera, in front of the camera. There's just a familial vibe to it, and that comes across, and it feels really good. Like, you guys, obviously, making a movie like Phantasm, which is a horror film, which is can be very terrifying at times, but also very lighthearted and silly at times. And then there's a musical number at times.
And then there's action.
There's action at times, and there's heartfelt moments, too. It's a 45-year-old movie that, I think, you know, obviously people have tattoos on their bodies of it. It stayed the test of time. Yeah. And you are a huge part of that.
Well, thank you. I never really felt that, you know. When it came out, I was just kind of blown away that, you know, it got the kind of attention that it got, you know. But and then, you know, of course, you know, the movie progressed, and it was a while before Don did Phantasm 2.
Right.
That was a time where Mike wasn't around. I wasn't around. I mean, I kind of moved on anyway, you know.
Yeah.
That was, you know, like the 20th Century Fox time when I was with them, and then the Mary Tyler Moore time. But that was okay. I mean, I was really embracing the fact that the movie had made a mark, you know, in the horror movie genre.
Right.
And but it wasn't really something that it's always been about the music with me, you know.
Yeah.
I realized when, you know, when my deal fell through with MTM and that didn't work out. We sold our home in LA and everything, and that was a rough time, and we moved up here because we had family up here, and I had a 1-week-old baby boy. Mm. I had a bit of a knee-jerk. Well, it wasn't. I think it was divine, actually. I think it was a God thing, because I said, Sharon came in, she said, no, when I was talking to the head of A&R from the company, and she knew what was being said, you know, and I said, let's move up into the Fresno area. And where our family is, your parents, and her brother had recently been killed by a drunk driver, and that was rough. You know, I mean, that's like life journey kind of stuff that happens. You know, there's some good and some stuff that's just horrible, you know. And
right,
so we brought this little baby boy up here to the Fresno area, and he became a tremendous distraction to my in-laws. He didn't replace their son, right?
Right.
But
right.
He was a tremendous distraction, you know, and they bonded like the most incredible thing that you would ever wish for a son or a daughter.
That's really special.
You know, and so it was really healing in a way. It's kind of emotional for me to talk about, but it's really not about me. It's not about us individually. It's about what we were talking about, making a difference and watching, you know, people bond together and enjoy and move on.
Right.
And get better, get some healing, you know, perhaps, you know.
That's the gift right there. That's the gift. I mean, not to cut you off, but you know, when you can have a moment, and I'm sure we all have had in some degree a level of tragedy in our lives, and you can take one of two directions, right? And if you're able to take it and find that positive thread and ride that thread, and you know, ultimately, I've told my son, everything happens for a reason, the good, the bad, the everything.
That's right.
You know, and you reflect on it 20 years from now and you go, oh, that thing that happened back then. And I said, why the hell did that happen?
Right.
And then you go, no, well, that's why.
But then then you go so far ahead and you're like, you start looking, and you know, a younger person is always like, oh, I would change this about my life, I'd change that. But when you get to a certain age, you're like, well, I love where I'm at. And if I changed anything, I don't know if I'd be here now. So I don't want to change anything about my life. That's what I think sometimes reflection will give you.
Right on, man. It's so true.
It's funny. Yeah. Our podcast is called Podcasting After Dark, but we try to maintain an extremely positive vibe about everything. We're never sarcastic. We're never snarky. And we try to be positive.
Yeah. I mean, you got to have light, you know.
You can't have darkness without the light.
About when when it's dark, that's awesome. And then the sun comes up the next day. I mean, it's all meant to, you know, just kind of be in concert together, right?
So, absolutely.
Yeah. So then, you know, Phantasm 2, you know, made its mark. And then Don called me. I had just received my teaching credential from Fresno State.
Oh, then you're a teacher too. You get it.
I was a music education major, you know.
Right on.
And I got my credential, and he called. And it was toward the end of the year, the teaching year, my Fresno State years. And he said, hey, I'm doing Phantasm 3. And he says, I need you to do the picture. And honestly, and I said, you know what, Don, I love you. But, you know, my life is like totally different, man. I'm not like in a totally different space right now. Like I said, I just got my credential. Like, I got a job. I start teaching in the fall. And he goes, Bill, I need you to do the picture. He said, it has everything to do with the original cast. I guess it's okay that I say this. He goes, what's it going to cost me?
Right.
And I just went, $1,000 a day. He goes, can you come down Thursday? Could you come down next Thursday and we'll just kind of get the process, do some reading and stuff like that. And I said, okay.
So, wow.
I know. So I thought, I had been doing commercials up here. I was a spokesman for the Central Valley Toyota dealers. And that was my only job that I had during the time. I wasn't even really, I was singing a lot because my instrument was my voice, you know, so
right.
I study all this German and French and Italian stuff, you know, just to get the you know, go jump through the hoops, right? That's yeah. what I had to do. And so I, you know, I just kind of moved through that whole deal with Toyota commercials and everything. And when I got down to be with Don and the rest of the gang, it was like the greatest reunion I had had. And this was 13 years after the original movie.
Yeah.
So it had been 13 years since I'd really seen anybody.
That's a trip.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I was just kind of taken aback by how beautiful it was to be back, you know, in something that was still happening. And so we had a great time shooting Phantasm 3. And I put a new roof on my house for the money that I made.
I mean, everything happens for a reason.
Well, that's perfect for me because Phantasm 3 is actually my favorite in the series. Well, I love 1, obviously. I love 1. But 3 is like my personal favorite. I very much enjoy that movie. But like, you know, and also, too, I just want to say real quick, Phantasm 2 is great because Jody's character, even though he's not in it, he's still a central part of that movie. He's still like the crutch of that film. And I always thought that was kind of awesome yeah. that even though he's not there, he's felt throughout Phantasm 2.
I guess there was some reference to Jody in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen it, you know. But yeah, so that was the beginning of it. And then I started to... Don said, hey, why don't you come to Chicago? There's a con thing there, a horror con or whatever, sci-fi thing. And he says, I think you'll really enjoy it. And I did. And I just, gosh, I mean, right before COVID, I think we did Boston, Louisville, did I say New York?
No, no, but you did New York.
And then Burbank. Anyway, I've done a whole bunch of them, and it's been really fun. And we've got one coming up in October, so we'll all be together again. Kat Lester's there, you know, and she lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I'm sure she's living a fairly good life then if she's living in Santa Fe. Because
she's got the pad of pads down there.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
It's really cool. I'm sure she would love to talk to you about that, Zach.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great.
A lot of fun. She's like a sister to me, you know.
And it's cool because the movie, much like in a way, if you think about it, it's like a song. It's unique, you know. The legacy of this series is unique. It's unlike anything else. It's created its own model that's never been duplicated. If you really think about it, nothing's ever come out that people go, oh, that's just like this movie. And that's a big testament to, like I've said earlier, everybody involved in the picture. I do want to ask you, though, because I just said I love sitting here at midnight so much. Can you? I'm sure you told this story a million times, but could you just kind of talk about the inception of that song or how it factored into the movie?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was given the job because of my musical background, because they were looking for somebody that had a musical thing going on.
Okay.
So I was, you know, always writing stuff. I actually wrote a tune for the movie, and Don's mom, Shirley, who I loved, she was like just a great friend, you know. She was also my makeup lady, right? And so I'd see her every day for 2 years or however many, you know, times I had to get made up. It was a lot. And she was just an incredible person, and she passed away, I don't know, it's been a while now, maybe almost 20 years ago, you know.
Okay.
But she was great. And but I think that I had pitched the tune to Don, you know, and he goes, well, I can't promise, man. I like it, but I can't promise. I'm not sure it's right, you know. And Shirley loved it. You know, I mean, she loved the song, but she gave me confidence. I wouldn't have pitched it if she had as his mother, you know, I mean, I,
right.
And that was kind of cool. But anyway, so then I, you know, when he said that, I thought, I'm not pushing this. I'm not going to push it. I, you know, I'll just move on. But I was, he said, I need a little tune just for you and Reg when you come in. When he comes over in this scene, and I wrote it there in my little trailer.
Wow.
Enough, just the opening line. And then we shot that, and then I continued writing the tune, and I finished the tune after that. And I really liked the full version. I didn't really love the part, you know, in the movie, but that,
It's a little rock and roll. It's a little rock and roll.
It's not about me again. You know, I mean, it's about the moment. And I realized when I sang the song at Coscarelli's book signing, somebody said, how come you didn't do the And okay, then I'll do it. Were you there when I did the
Yeah, I was.
Oh, actually. You were? Yeah. Okay, well, anyways.
I was in the rafters starting to come in, and I'm like, I want to be able to see this.
But
it's a little Loggins and Messina, if you will.
I wasn't thrilled with when I saw it, and I used to cringe when I would see it because my voice sounded so thin, and I blamed it on the lavalier microphone that was around my neck or whatever it was, because it wasn't even in that when we did that, there wasn't a boom there.
Oh, okay.
And I'm kind of an audio guy. And
yeah, of course.
I thought, I don't sound that thin, you know? And so that always really, like, I'd always leave the room if the movie was playing during that scene because of the sound of my voice.
Oh no.
But you know, again, that's shrink stuff, you know, that's I need counseling kind of things, you know.
Now we all go through that. It's like not enjoying the sound of your own voice kind of deal.
You know it's huge, you know, yeah. So the sound of the voice bothered me, but it is what it is. And you just have to, you know, keep going and forget it.
Just deal with it.
Yeah, my wife had said, get well, you know. Get over it.
And, you know, speaking of Don Coscarelli's mom, we saw her in Kenny and Company because Zach and I are, you know, currently, well, the idea is that we're going to go through his entire filmography in order. And we started with Jim, the World's Greatest. We're on to Kenny and Company. Yeah. Now we're doing Phantasm. And you can see the progression and everything. But one thing that, and having just watched Phantasm for the millionth time last night, you know, for the millionth time, you really do get the sense that everyone there is a family. You know, you there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, you're Michael Baldwin's older brother and Reggie's like the best friend that's been in everyone's life this whole entire time. And how much of that is because of the behind the scenes, you know, is a family affair and everything. But, you know, but the fact that that's what comes across on screen is what I think really helps to keep this movie, you know, Phantasm, alive and well and growing all these years, probably from a cult movie to a movie that most people have heard of now, you know, no longer cult anymore.
Well, maybe you're right about that. You know, it's the trickle down effect. I think that comes from
right.
The top. And Don had the ability to connect people, you know, and he had a wonderful, you know, set of parents, you know, that were so supportive of him, you know. And he told me recently, you know, he goes, you know, the bottom line, he says, about Phantasm is what went down between you and Mike and Rich, you know.
Yeah.
He says that was really what did made the picture what it is, was the trio, you know. And yeah, and suddenly, you know, I began to really, it was a wonderful thing to hear that, you know, from the man himself. He didn't say it was all about Don Coscarelli, right?
No, like, you never feel that.
You know, it's not, it's about us. And that's, I think, what happened. And I remember being called back. I'd gone down to Long Beach. I met them in their parent, in Don's, you know, home, you know, in Long Beach. And I got called back, and I knew that I really liked Don at the moment, you know, when I first met him, and very supportive and wanting me to be comfortable. And Paul Pepperman was right with him. And Paul sat next to me at Dark Delicacies at that signing. Great guy. And then it came down to me and another actor. And so then there was a screen test. And that was really in Don Coscarelli's parents' driveway.
Oh, wow.
I met Mike Baldwin that day, you know. And
little punk kid, Mike Baldwin at the time.
Yeah, after Kenny and Company and all that. Right. I'd gone to, he had given me the movie Kenny and Company. And I'd watched it and everything and watched him and really admired him and thought he was really great.
Oh, yeah. That whole movie is just fantastic.
And so I really think it was Mike Baldwin, his feeling about me that got the role. I think Don liked me, I guess, but Mike Baldwin sealed the deal because we just got along real well, you know, and I did a scene with him there, and then I got the call to do the movie, and I just was kind of amazed. And but I've downplayed my role for years. I've downplayed it, you know. It wasn't until recently I did a on-the-air interview with Ray Appleton. He's a heavy-duty radio guy here in the Central Valley. The Ray Appleton show, and he's interviews them all. I mean, he does heavy-duty political things and everything in between. He's kind of a rocker, you know, in his own right. You know, loves to play, sing, and he's just a great guy. But yeah, and he took that movie and dusted it off and made it seem relevant, you know, again. And people just responded to that particular show on KMJ 580. If you ever want to check it out, it was fun. He played the audio version of the trailer to start the show out. You know, the whole boy thing. And if this one doesn't scare you, you're already dead. And then he introduced me, and then he worked in my Cheyenne Remington Ridge music video into that too. And he goes, "How do you go from horror films to cowboy things?" And so we were able to tying things together and seeing how things work together.
Yeah. Does that still live on? Does that live on YouTube? That interview.
You know, I think if you just go on KMJ 580 on that, you can go to the Ray Appleton show and just scroll down there and you'll see the Bill Thornberry interview on there. But that was really a tremendously fun interview.
Yeah, it's cool when, you know, I think sometimes radio and audio are a lost form in some degree, I think, or forgotten, you know, and when people are reminded that just listening to something and the power of just listening to something, you know, we do that with music all the time. And fortunately with podcasts, it seems to be coming back into fashion.
Thanks to COVID, right?
Yeah. really, if you think about it, Corey and I've been doing this for 5 years. We did it right before COVID started, and next thing you know, we're like, "Oh, I'm glad we're starting this now because it's coming in handy."
Got a good thing going here. I'm honored to be with you guys. This is great.
We're honored to have you. And I was gonna say, you went from one power trio of Mike, Reggie, and Jody to this new power trio with Remington Ridge.
Yeah.
I never
thought about that, but it is a trio.
It is. Yeah. Now you've released music prior to this. You had, is it fair to say you had a solo record that is more faith-based, right? That came out.
I did a faith-based record to start with, called Five Loaves, Two Fishes. We did. Okay. It was a great project. I did it with a guy named Lloyd Clift, who was a recording engineer at Warner Brothers Records.
Oh, cool.
But we had moved to LA together as singer. He was a singer as well, and a good one. And he had gone through some really difficult times. Everybody does. And anyway, he was really good friends with Tommy Johnson. Actually, he was the lead singer and writer of the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah, Tommy Johnston is fantastic.
Yeah. And anyway,
Bay Area guys, they're from the Bay Area.
That's right. Sausalito and all that.
Right.
But anyway, Tommy Johnston, he talked to him about doing this record. And Tommy said, look, I've got this equipment I'm not using. I'm just going to give it to you. So he gives Lloyd, this recording equipment, right?
What?
Time, right? It was just 8 tracks. And he was like, Tommy was cutting demos and stuff with it, or just working out tunes and stuff. So he sends this equipment down to Visalia, right, where Lloyd lived. He left the music business and recovered.
Yeah.
Through a huge recovery process, you know.
That's great. That's great.
And so I started writing. I started writing for this project, and it was great. It's great to have something that narrows down the field, So I started writing this song called Stay the Course, And if you should pull that, of all the projects that I worked on, the Five Loaves, Two Fishes is my favorite.
Five Loaves, Two Fishes, okay.
Because of the meaning behind it all.
Yeah, what's the meaning? Tell us.
Well, just the recovery, the recovery of addiction issues and of faith, the spiritual aspect of the importance of spiritual transformation. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like the Christian thing. I'm not a real, I don't go every Sunday or anything like that. But
are your hands getting hot as you say that? I'm kidding.
it's just a very real but very deeply personal, situation to me.
Yeah.
And that's how it was with Lloyd too, So I wrote this tune. The second cut on there was called one called Break My Heart. And that's about the homeless thing and breaking your heart open so that other, people can have a helping to that.
That's beautiful.
That soulful, kind of expression of help. Check out Break My Heart on Five Loaves, Two Fishes. I think
it will do.
The other one I'd like to, the whole record's really nice. It was done in 8 tracks. And late Lee Hirschberg, who was head of Warner Brothers Engineering, who cut stuff early on in his career with Frank Sinatra live and everything.
Yeah.
He was retired at the time. When he heard it, he goes, Lloyd, I'll master this thing myself.
Whoa.
Okay, so he took this little 8-track project and mastered it and made Five Loaves, Two Fishes what it is. And I just think if it was given a little bit more exposure, I think it would have been perhaps a little, it would have touched even more people than it did. One of the last tunes on there that I wrote was called It's Not For Us to Know.
Okay.
And one of my former students, when I was teaching, I was in a middle school situation, the first teaching gig that I had. And this little girl, her name was Christy, and she had graduated from the school, was in high school. I think she was a sophomore or so, maybe a junior. And she came into my classroom brokenhearted, because her boyfriend that she had, that she went to the winter formal with and everything, and it was a beautiful thing for her, he injured himself in a wood shop accident where something came off the lathe at a heavy, high velocity, and he received traumatic brain injury and
oh no,
and didn't survive.
Oh wow.
So she comes into my office in tears. Mr. Thornberry, why do things like this happen to the people?
Yeah.
I didn't know what to say. I was at a loss for words, and I just said, I don't know, Christy. I don't know why. It doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. Anyway, I took that home, and then I got the tune, man, and it came through. And it was right at the end of, we were getting ready to get everything out. And I said, Lord, we need to do this tune. And he said, I agree. I cut it guitar vocal to a click track. And we sent it to a buddy of mine, Barney Robertson in Nashville, who's a great friend. And he put in this flute whistle kind of thing in there and added some keyboard strings to it. And that's what it became. And, you know, that tune has been used quite a few times. And I've performed that tune many times for situations like that. So it's called It's Not For Us To Know. And it's the last cut on that Five Loaves, Two Fishes album.
Did she ever hear it? Did Christy ever hear
it? Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, she got in touch with me. Her dad, this was, 30 some years ago.
Right? Okay.
She got in touch with me because her dad, Mike, who I knew because I was her music teacher and he was a great guy, he had become ill and he had passed away. And she said the song has made a full circle now from the time that she lost her friend. And then again, when her dad passed away, and they played that song at Shirley's Coscarelli's funeral.
Wow. Oh, man.
You know, I don't think I could have sung it at her funeral anyway.
I feel like that would have been really hard.
I'm kind of a mess, actually. I'm sort of an emotional, you know, my emotion.
No, it's a beautiful thing though, to be that way, because you know, that's real. And
we need more of that. We need more real in this world, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't my dad was, I didn't see my dad cry. I didn't see my dad cry until my wedding.
Oh, well, he cried at your wedding.
He did. He was a blubbering mess at my wedding. And I never heard my dad say, I love you until my wedding.
Right here. You know, similar situations with our dads, you know.
And there's a thing. My stepdad was a huge piece of my life, and Corey knows this. He pretty much was the one who raised me for the better part of my childhood. And so I look to not your blood, but you look to the people in your life that show you love, right?
Oh yeah.
And showing you that you can be emotional and it's okay, and it's so important, especially for young, you know, men and boys to know that it's okay to be emotional. It's good to be emotional. You're wearing that on your sleeve. You should just have talking about tattoos, you should get a heart tattooed on your arm because you wear it on your sleeve all the time. I love that. Like coming on our show and, you know, we could talk horror movies all day, whatever. We could talk music all day, but every element of who you are is wrapped up in all of these stories. It's not just one, it's everything.
Yeah, it does. It is.
I do want to ask you really quickly about, I want a rough segue into Remington Ridge and your song Cheyenne, because Cheyenne's a beautiful song as well.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, we will promote your music as well. And we'll put links to all your stuff. And
would love for you to do that. I know my new trio would really appreciate that. I've got Delisai Johnson, she's really a virtuoso on the fiddle, and
she sure is. The track itself,
she sings well too. Sings well.
Okay.
And
I do want to say really quickly too. You know, we have a very strong audience, and it's a very diverse audience. It's funny, like Corey said, we focus on a lot of cult and horror films, but it's eclectic as far as our audience is concerned, and it's very vast. And we have a music loving audience as well. So we'll make sure that Remington Ridge, and all your stuff gets promoted.
Yeah, I'll put all of that in the show notes and everything. So everyone listening here, go check the show notes. There will be links in the show notes. You can go listen to all those tracks.
Thank you, Corey. You guys are great together, and I just wish you just the greatest success, you know, as you move forward with this podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
I'll do this anytime. You know?
Oh, right on. Well, hey, you know, hopefully we can do it in person one of these days.
Well, that'd be kind of fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but sure,
wild. Hey, look me up, man. We're just right here at the foot of the Sierra Nevadas. I have a cabin up at Shaver Lake, and I can be there in an hour. In fact, I'm either going to go up there this afternoon and check on things but I'll probably not go up until tomorrow because
my mom lives up in Sonora, not too far from
gold country.
Yeah, it is gold country.
Town and all that.
Well, if you ever make your way up here to Eugene, Oregon, let me know.
You know what, Corey? I would love to pay you a visit in Oregon. Sure. I like to travel when we can. And we like the Pacific Coast. We love living in California. I don't like the taxation here in California.
No.
Some of that kind of stuff, but we love the Pacific Northwest and, driving up, or we took the train up for an anniversary one time and took the Coast Starlight and went up to Seattle, and then we went.
Oh, I've been wanting to do that, yeah.
And then we came down, rented a car, and drove all the way down the coast from Seattle all the way down, you know, to California and through Big Sur up in Northern California. I mean, it was just, there's so much to enjoy, you know, here.
That's gorgeous.
This coast.
Yeah.
And it's inspirational too, as far as music is concerned. When you're writing a song or a tune comes into your mind, really quickly, because I ask this often of our guests if they're musically inclined to some degree. Have you ever heard of an artist named Terry Reid?
Terry Reid, songwriter?
Songwriter, yep. So his famous or infamous story is that he turned down being in Led Zeppelin. He was good buddies with Jimmy Page. Jimmy's looking for a new singer or whatever.
One of those.
Yeah, it's one of those stories, but his singer-songwriter skills are amazing. He's got a song called Faith to Arise.
Okay.
And it's, in my opinion, it's one of my favorite songs of all time.
Faith to Arise?
Faith to Arise, yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna Google that or YouTube or whatever.
Terry Reid is the guy.
I'm going to definitely check that out. You know, those close calls, you know, if you've just done this or that
with Terry Reid. Right.
I just have to tell you guys this, though.
Please.
Getting back to the movie thing. I can't remember exactly the timeline, but I did get a call from my agent. She goes, I want you to go meet this man at the old Samuel Goldwyn Studios. He's making a science fiction picture. Well, I got there, and I walked in, and he said, hello, my name is George Lucas, and I'm looking at people right now for the movie. And I was a moron that day, and I did not self-promote. I didn't promote him. In retrospect, I wish I had said, you know what? You're fantastic. American Graffiti is like in my wheelhouse, man. I love that movie, and I push a broomstick around the set just to be in your presence. I mean, but I sat there like this.
Oh, man.
Waited for him to ask questions.
Yeah.
And you know what he said at the end? I'm not reading anybody right now. I'm just getting a feel. And I said, well, good luck, and left.
Oh, wow.
What a fool. And so fast forward. I don't know how we got there, but opening night was Star Wars at Grauman's Chinese Theater. Sharon and I were sitting right in the middle. I don't remember where I got the tickets, but I was there, and it was all mostly industry people in there, and it was a wild audience, man. I mean, crazy.
I bet.
And then when that spaceship comes over right at the very beginning, I see Sharon's gaze looking right at me. Going,
oh, no. Daggers.
You know what? It is what it is, and I'm not saying that I would have been the Luke Skywalker. I'm not, come on. But at least I could have given myself a shot at it.
Right.
I could have self-promoted and given him the praise he deserved yeah. at that point, just to give myself an opportunity to get called back.
That's wild.
I didn't get called back, and it was my fault.
Okay. I will tell you, though, you're talking about those crazy moments or things that we have happened in our lives. Everything happens for a reason, you know? And like you said at the beginning of this, you're looking out at your grandson playing, and you got a beautiful daughter-in-law that helped you set up the Zoom today. So,
right. No, I've got it all. Man, you see my garden out here, man. I've got a beautiful garden.
That's life right there.
This season, man.
It's life right there, you know? We take the little things for granted.
It is.
You know, and sometimes you see the beauty through the voice of a child sometimes, you know, with what they say and how prophetic their words can be. And you're like, man, it's good perspective, you know.
Bodie's been great perspective.
Bodie's been around Corey long enough to have moments of like that. And he's got a great nephew as well in Grey Bear. And
isn't that cool? Fine?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, you know, but... You know, Bill, we could talk to you all day. I feel like we need to be sitting around a campfire right now drinking something special and celebrating the fact that we get to do this together. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you
and
so
being
much.
A part of
this
our lives.
Yeah, this was absolutely just amazing. Just a dream come true. Thank you so much.
Corey, Zachary, thank you. May our paths overlap again real soon, okay?
Thank you for listening to Podcasting After Dark's exclusive interview series with Bill Thornbury. And, as always, thank you for your support.